I'm Stephanie Overbuck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold.
It should pay to do good work. For so many organizations, the drive to make positive social impact is strong, but the funding needed to keep that work going is missing. How can we rethink the way we do business to make social impact work sustainable in the long term?
In this episode, we are speaking with Karen Krieger, a specialist in social entrepreneurship and the social and solidarity economy. We ask her to share her perspective on inclusive models for social, environmental, and economic growth that go beyond the for-profit versus non-profit narrative. Here's Karen.
So my name is Karen Krieger. I am a specialist, I suppose, in the social and solidarity economy with a particular focus on social entrepreneurship. I'm South African and my work has focused quite a lot on understanding what social entrepreneurship looks like in South Africa, but then also more recently with my work with the International Labour Organization is also looking really about how do we integrate these social and economic models in the African context. You know, it's very interesting because it's not really a career. No one really starts out to be a specialist in a field like social entrepreneurship or the social and solidarity economy, which combines so much of so many different fields. But essentially how I came to this was a deep frustration with working in the nonprofit sector and working in charities and struggling to figure out how are they not sustainable? How are we still struggling after all these years to really achieve impact? Why don't we understand the circumstances that we're working in? And that frustration actually catalyzed a crazy career journey, which is where I am now, which is actually in Belgium, wrapping up my doctorate in social entrepreneurship. So there's Karen in 30 seconds, but actually that's the last 15 years.
That's really a good start, though, because I think many of us don't really even have a clue what is social entrepreneurship or entrepreneurism. Could you give us a definition or at least a description?
No, I can't, even after doing a dissertation. And I think that's the point. I mean, come on, like entrepreneurship is a hard word to spell, let alone pronounce. And then we have all these very different interpretations of what it looks like and what it feels like and how people relate to it. And I think that's what makes it such a special field for somebody like me who kind of, I really enjoy being in a space that's quite complex and where there are no hard and fast answers. And hey, social entrepreneurship is a space with no hard and fast answers. But just so that we can anchor the conversation in something, otherwise you will end up in my PhD and it's a very messy space. When we talk about social entrepreneurship, we really are talking about how do you take the best of that the business world offers us, which is often organizations that are financially sustainable. They are stable because they have this financially stable base. And blend that with the best that the charity sector offers, which is values and principles and embedded in the logic of communities and responsive to the needs of communities. And how do you take the best of these worlds and bring them together? And I think that very simplistically is probably one of the best ways to describe what social entrepreneurship or the social and solidarity economy is, because now you're really starting to get into definitional spaces. Is how do you make sure that that organizations that do good are well supported, are responsive to the needs of our societies and communities and aren't treated as other, which I think often we find so much of our conversations are driven by business. Like if I drive to work in the morning, not in Belgium, because here I'm on a bicycle, but in South Africa, when I drive to work in the morning, I hear a financial report and I hear what the stock markets are doing, not just in my own country, but globally, but I hear nothing other than the terrible, dismal state of our social development. And I think this is where social entrepreneurship is a powerful conversation because it holds the middle, right? It brings these two conversations together. And I firmly believe is at the heart of all of our discussions around building inclusive economies and inclusive societies.
Do you really believe that that's possible? I mean, a lot of the topics that we discuss on this podcast end up pointing to how profit-driven corporations oftentimes externalize social costs in order to make a profit, and that the incentives are not going away. There's always an incentive to kind of cut the cost, which impacts people and impacts our climate. How can we kind of blend these two models that in one aspect or another seem almost diametrically opposed in the way they operate?
They're not. And I think that's the first fallacy in our logic, is that we think that they sit on opposite ends of a spectrum. And I describe it like that because it's one of the easiest ways for us to understand it. But I think if you look historically, you see that business has been forced to become a lot more socially responsive because it cannot operate in a bubble. And I think it is a complete fallacy to think that this is the natural state of affairs. I think I'm not an economist and I'm not an economic historian by any stretch of the imagination, but we know that great businesses are connected to their societies. And I don't think that's an argument. I think we accept that. What I do push back against is why we don't give equivalent attention to the organizations that exist primarily for social and environmental benefit. And I think a lot of it is because the logic of the quantitative logic, the financial logic, the logic that drives the value of profit as a return is so easy for us to understand. It's so simple to understand that if I make more money, that equals good, right? It's good for the company. It's good for the employees. It's good for stakeholders. It's great. You know, you can even argue it's great for society. And part of the problem, I think, is that we haven't put enough effort into understanding what the logics are of social, which are far more complex to understand, because what I do today, I may not see the benefit of that even in my lifetime. So we operate with very short-term horizons. The reality of working in the social and the environmental space, as we know, they are very long-term horizons, but it doesn't mean that they need to be, that they should be treated differently. And we need to create a space where we value the social and the environmental equally to the quantitative logic of profit. I don't like the phrase profit, but I think it's an easy way to make the point. I mean, to be honest, I'm going to interrupt myself, which is something I do often, but COVID has shown us that, right? We've all come out of COVID and should be coming out of COVID with a much greater or stronger sense of well-being, of the importance of health, of the importance of our humanity, of how we provided support to each other. And it didn't come through a profit-driven motive, but it's very easy to default back to what we know. And so when you talk about an inclusive economy, I think we really need to appreciate that we are not just talking about organizational change, but we really are talking about a philosophical values. We're talking about different values and appreciating the values of togetherness and collaboration over competition, which is something that's hard. It's hard to do because it's not ingrained in us. We haven't been taught that.
I mean, I think we grapple a lot with values-based organizations versus profit-driven organizations. And of course, you can have a profit-driven organization that has a strong value-based core, right? That is driven by values. And a lot of the structure really depends on who's benefiting from the profit, whether it's the stakeholders being the shareholders or the customers or the employees. I mean, oftentimes it seems that where the profits go has as much of an impact on kind of the ability to maintain values as how many profits there are. I mean, that seems to be kind of a common difference between different organizations. But I have a question about how you mentioned that value-based organizations, you said, are sometimes not sustainable. And you mentioned being frustrated with the charitable domain. How is that true? Is that they're not financially sustainable, or they're just not, they die out? Because there's a lot of nonprofits that have been around for hundreds of years.
So if I can talk to the first part of your point, which I think you've actually captured it far better than I have, than what I was trying to explain, which is that we treat these things as either or, and they're not either or. They're the same thing, different sides of the very same coin. When you look at a lot of the academic literature, it talks about moral economies, not just solidarity economy. It's where the social and solidarity economy comes from. Family-based economies, these are all economies that are driven on value, you know, principles of value. It's not saying that the profits economy is not values driven. It's just that it puts the achievement of profit over at times, and I'm hugely generalizing here, obviously, because we're talking about these extremes. But what we're talking about when we're talking about inclusive economies is how do you build or strengthen the presence of these moral economies, because they have an equal role to play. It's not saying that there isn't a space for business or, you know, pure profit motive driven business. There is absolutely as much need for those organizations as there is for pure charity, which is dependent on grants. You know, welfare organizations, when I was working for an organization like Child Welfare, you know, you're working in child protection. It's very hard to introduce income earning models into any organization that's working in such a critically important statutory space. So there is a need for welfare, but we've got to open up the middle. We've got to bring these two opposite sides together so that we can really strengthen the space of the solidarity economy, strengthen the space where the collaborative economy operates over a competitive economy, and really strengthen this moral economy that we know we have, but it kind of sits a little out of the spotlight. It sits in the shadows, and it really shouldn't. In terms of the sustainability for nonprofit organizations, I think this is very much financial sustainability. That, you know, I know sustainability is a big word. It's got a lot of different meanings in a lot of different spaces and places. But when we look at organizations that are dependent on grants, they're essentially dependent on our goodwill to function. And so they are constantly on the back foot as they have to motivate the value of their work to people who will gift them funds and enable them to do their work. And it creates an inherent power imbalance in our society, and also means that organizations are never able to make decisions that they regard as essential, because they're always, you know, kind of guided by donor criteria rather than their specialist expertise. And so, again, when I talk about bringing these organizations front and center, I think the financial model is one of the easiest ways we can do this, because these organizations shouldn't be struggling to access funding or finance. They should be well-funded, well-supported, well-resourced, and we should be looking at different ways to resource them so that they have the ability to make decisions based on their expertise, not based on donor needs and wants.
I see. So what would be a model that would, or a different type of model to sustain these organizations financially?
So I think this is where the social enterprise model is why it's kind of positioned as this kind of nice space where people enjoy playing and discussing and trying to figure it out, because this is the model where organizations exist to deliver, you know, goods and services that are needed and required by communities and by societies. But instead of relying on grants, they are then able to earn an income. So it really shifts the dynamic. One of the great things about profit, which is why I'm always cautious of the word profit, because it's kind of, it's a very loaded phrase. It comes with a lot of attachments around, you know, we associate it with exploitation and manipulation. But actually what happens when you introduce a profit motive or an income stream to a social organization, and you attach a price to goods and services, you shift the relationship with your beneficiary, who, instead of becoming a beneficiary, somebody who is a recipient of a free service, they become a customer, they become a client, they have choice, they can tell you that they don't like what you're providing them with. And so you see the introduction of this phrase profit into the charity sector can have quite a profound shift in how the sector functions. But having said that, I want to be very clear about this. Profit is not the panacea to solve the lack of stability that social organizations have. As I said earlier, with child wealth, with, you know, there's some organizations that really do need to be supported by our societies and shouldn't have to have an income attached to them. You don't want to have to pay for a child protection service. So again, it's about, when we look at things on a spectrum, it's about opening up the middle of the spectrum between pure business and between pure charity, and opening up the range of organizations that exists in between that blend the best of the social and the economic and the environmental realms. And that's very much what we talk about when we talk a social economy, social and solidarity economy, and social entrepreneurship.
Okay, so let's focus on the middle. At least in the United States, I'm not sure if it's universal, but we have what we call B Corporation, which is it pays taxes. You know, it can generate income that is profitable, but it also has a set of kind of legal values or incorporated values that the organization adheres to throughout its life cycle. Is that the kind of organization you're talking about? And if so, do you have examples of other organizations or such organizations that kind of live in the middle and are successfully sustaining themselves?
Yeah, so B Corps is a great example of social enterprises. You also have other ways of validating. I mean, it's a way of validating that the organization has a social and an economic focus to it. As I said, you know, social is such a fuzzy space because it lacks kind of hard and fast definitions that we do need something to latch onto. And so B Corp is one of those ways that we validate or we legitimize the social enterprise model. You also in the US, you have a social enterprise mark. In the UK, they've got different organizations like the CIC, the Community Interest Company, also Social Enterprise UK. There's a mark that exists in the UK. Now, this is important, but it's more of a, it's kind of the middle of the conversation and not the beginning of the conversation. And when we look at what social entrepreneurship looks like in an African context, or specifically in my context, South Africa, we must not forget that organizations are often not registered, or it's one person who is responding to the needs in their community, and they don't have a set of books. They're not getting their finances, you know, audited and submitting that to the regulatory authority. But at the same time, they're providing essential services in areas where government can't reach, won't reach, doesn't have the capacity to reach. And so I hear you when we talk about B Corp and CICs, but one of the big things that I've certainly turned to over the last couple of years is that we mustn't continue to only focus on this kind of organizational model of social enterprise. We mustn't forget that in countries, particularly where that these might be complex country contexts, we mustn't forget that sometimes it's just as a one man or a one woman band doing great things. And our role and responsibility is to support them to be sustainable in their community. And we also need to simultaneously adjust our focus on scaling. Because the value of these people is that they are highly localized and they're very trusted. And as inequality grows globally, this trust that these social entrepreneurs have in their communities is quite profound. And is a good antidote to the lack of trust as we kind of grow into big business, big government spaces. And so increasingly, I think we need to look at ways of scaling where we can support people to stay local rather than recognizing success as being something where you've expanded your geographic footprint. And so what I'm trying to say is that I don't think we should just focus the conversation on the established organizations that have a board of governors, that you know, are like your Ben and Jerry's before it got sold off. And, you know, this is a nice, or Patagonia, you know, great. There are established examples of social enterprises that are well-known worldwide. But I think that they're actually a very small part of the social enterprise conversation. And as our conversation becomes more nuanced, we're going to appreciate the role of that small, micro, informal enterprise in community, in a difficult country context, doing great things. And our question to ourselves is always, what do we need to do to support them to be better at what they do?
I was wondering, Karen, if it sounds fantastic, right? And I think the conversation we're having is super important for society and how we're going to develop as society, actually even as humanity. Yet I don't see these buzzwords we just used in our conversation here in, let's say, in the mass media. Yeah, in the mass media, I think there is more like, there's always a hero, right? Now, currently, I think the hero is kind of more Elon Musk, you know, and sometimes he's called a social entrepreneur, or I don't want to give too many examples, but I hope you know what I mean, right? So could there be, or do we maybe need that kind of story? Like, do we need to find a hero in that kind for that kind of development of movement? Or do you have already one? You know, like a, you know, someone like a, I don't know, who stands for what you talk about.
Yeah, so I I'm a bit allergic to the hero-heroine narrative.
Me too. But it's, you know, it's the Hollywood kind of way to do business.
Yeah, I think it misplaces things in it. It also creates an expectation, which I think completely detracts from the complexity of these fields. I mean, there are people doing excellent work in the South African environment. Just off the top of my head, organizations like Abalobi, you're looking at Neo Hutiri at Technovera, you're looking at the Clothing Bank. I mean, as examples of social enterprises, Abalobi is working with fishing communities to strengthen these fishers whose livelihoods have generally been stripped as our South African coastline is overfished. They don't have a seat at the table to negotiate prices. Government regulation in the past has very much been decided without them. And here you have this fantastic organization set up by Serge, actually off the back of his PhD. And he goes to these communities on the west coast of South Africa and he says, what do you guys need? How do we bring each other together? And so slowly introducing the concept of responsible fishing, the fish to plate scenarios. And so that when, you know, me and my, you know, posh Belgian, well, I'm a student, so I don't want to say posh, but, you know, so I know where my fish comes from when I order it in a restaurant. And so, you know, you're working on both ends of the supply chain to ensure responsibility in the system. Neo Hutiri has done phenomenal work. I mean, now I'm actually falling into my own trap, going phenomenal work and creating a hero, but I'm just using these focus examples. But Neo was diagnosed with TB after and wasn't on a private healthcare system and found himself standing in a queue in one of our large, very large public hospitals, Baragwanath. But I don't know if you know, tuberculosis really requires a very strict antibiotic regime. It's very treatable, but you have to take that medicine. And in the public health system in South Africa, he was queuing like 4 to 6 hours a week to access this medicine. And what did he do? He, you know, he's a great engineer. He's got a great innovative brain. And as he was standing there, he's like, why don't we just introduce these automatic lockers? People receive the PIN number on their phone. When their medicine's dispensed by the public health pharmacist, they get a message. They can, you know, it's this kind of work that really has a profound effect on the system, but at the same time is sustainable in that you can see where the spaces and places are to introduce income earning models so that it's not just dependent on large donors to sustain their work. These people deserve the credit because they're doing the hard work. But I would like to caution against creating this hero-heroine narrative of what the social entrepreneur is, because I think it takes away also from the sheer complexity of their work and I think possibly discourages people to embark on being social entrepreneurs because everybody feels they've got to be this award-winning social entrepreneur, whereas actually not the best, but social entrepreneurs are you and I. They're people who see something in their community, they get irritated by the waste that's in their river system. And they say, I'm going to do something about it. And they do. And that is what needs to be celebrated, is that action that people take to outside of their personal lives to actually work towards something that has a benefit for everyone.
We've discussed universal basic income and the experiments in Finland they did. I don't know if you heard about this. Experiment they've done for 25 months in Finland, and we are yet doing a follow-up episode with them. But super interesting to hear, right? And I was just wondering, could something like an overlay with universal basic income, for example, or some sort of universal basic income for social enterprises kind of solve the problem, or partly the problem?
I'm not sure I'm understanding the question correctly, but universal basic income is different to a social enterprise model. But the connecting principles are around unrestricted income. One of the values of social protection is important, particularly in countries which are, I suppose, opposite to Finland. And I lived in Finland for a year when I finished school, so I sort of know it. But in countries like South Africa, our inequality would be even more awful than it is if we didn't have social protection built into our system. And I'm always very grateful for that. what universal basic income does, the value of that in terms of the social enterprise conversation is when you have the choice as to how you spend the money that you're essentially accessing through state systems is hugely empowering, right? But not just for the individual who can now make decisions as to how they spend that income, but also for the community within which they operate. So what we really try to do, and the economists will tell you this better than I can, is make sure that that dollar or that one rand spends as much time in that community as it possibly can. So you build up the local economy, and in doing so, you strengthen you really build up this society and that community. What we're seeing in countries like South Africa is that a lot of that grant money goes out of those communities. It goes out into the big supermarket chains for bread and milk, rather than that being sourced locally. And so again, that's part of our inverting how we see our economies and moving away from these very centralized models, which tend to be structured in urban centers. You go to the city or the town center to buy your goods, your bread and milk, whereas actually, how do we decentralize that and enable access to people to access basic needs close to home and by entrepreneurs close to home? So let me give you an example of that. When I was doing my PhD data collection, this was one of the things I found quite profound, was that up until now, coming out of a business school, my picture of social enterprise was pretty nicely set on the Western model, which is, you know, everything we've spoken about, the public school, you know, the schools that are set up that you pay for, healthcare that you can access, but you pay for, there's an income stream that's attached to it in kind of a commercial way that makes it look a little bit like a business, but it's a business that's got a social heart to it. But when you actually study South Africa's social entrepreneurs, they are people who I at one point would say, but that's not social. So, for example, what we found is that there are a lot of people who are growing vegetables in their communities. Now, to me, you're just growing vegetables in your community, and they're selling those vegetables in their community. But why? And the motivation here is crucial. And the why is because these communities live far from the closest town. They take away the need for people to travel into town to access basic goods and services. The vegetables and the food gets damaged on the very bad roads as people come back in. And there's no storage facilities. So now you see the motivation for the social entrepreneur is not just purely commercial. It's really about addressing some of the fundamental systemic issues that that community faces when they need to access basic goods and services. Now, to me, that's classic social. In a city, that would not be a social enterprise. In a rural area, absolutely. And it's a great example for me of how we're seeing this model that's pushing back against this urban center where everything happens in the cities, and that the social enterprise is kind of this big enterprise that looks a bit like a business. We need to create a little bit more of a nuanced view of what social is and what it looks like, particularly in complex countries.
I wanted to shift a little bit to the solidarity economy that you refer to, because I don't think we've touched on that. And I'm not sure I understand what is the solidarity economy. What does that mean?
So the social and solidarity economy is actually the big system. This is the space of, if you look at it organizationally, you would be looking at cooperatives, burial societies or societies, mutuals, credit unions. It's the economy where people work with each other, for each other, essentially, and has a really, really strong base in Europe, but also you see across Latin America, and is growing, and is social entrepreneurship forms part of this. So again, if we're looking at that spectrum where we've got pure business on one side and pure charity on the other, in the middle, you could just say is the social and solidarity economy. And in here, we have a mix of organizations that plot across the spectrum in different ways. So they can either be business with some elements of social, but then as they move across the spectrum closer to the social side, you see them becoming a lot more social and potentially less kind of business oriented. But within this middle of the spectrum is a lot of different organizational forms around which you can realize how your social is done. So your cooperatives, for example, highly democratic organizations. Your societies are also, you know, very, you know, or saving scheme, your credit union saving schemes where people each put in money every month and you know, one member pulls out the pool of money at the end. So you see different ways of people investing and connecting and collaborating towards a connected or a connected vision, right? So there's something that glues people together. It can be a community of interest, it can be a geographic community, it can be a community of savings, you know, what have you. And that is very much what underpins the solidarity side of the social and solidarity economy, these principles of reciprocity, of mutualism and of solidarity. I think it's important to acknowledge that social organizations are not always good. And so we always need to keep a critical mind rather than just accepting that an organization, if it professes to be good, is good. Because ultimately what might be good for one community is not good for another. And I think we've seen this throughout history. I mean, colonialism is a great example. It's, you know, benefited one country at the expense of another. You know, I think South Africa's history, you can see that thread running through it strongly. There are other things like, also we shouldn't be charging. So when we talk about social enterprise and we want unrestricted income, there are some things you actually just shouldn't charge for, in my mind. So the city that I grew up in, Gqeberha, is in the throes of a very, very, very severe water crisis. And in response to this, you see a lot of shops popping up selling water, and it's cost effective, right? It's less than a dollar. And in a way, everybody can access water. And when I mean severe water crisis, the city is going to run out of water by the end of this month, which is in the next kind of 10 odd days. And it's a big industrial city. This is where General Motors used to be, Mercedes, Volkswagen, it's all in this metro. So the thing is, the social enterprises are doing what I would expect them to do. They're responding to a neglected problem. They're providing a service that people need. They're doing it at what you could argue is an affordable rate, although affordability is obviously personal. But here's my issue. Water is a basic human right, and no one should have to charge for access to potable water. And so we've got to be very careful about how we commoditize and what we commoditize. And we must always do this with a very critical and keen eye. And so going back to your point about what is right and our values, I think we've got a very good book of values, and those are those UN principles on human rights. What are our basic human rights? And I think we must always, irrespective of our culture and irrespective of the countries we come from and the religions we prescribe to and all those institutions that basically shape our expectations and values and philosophies, we are bound by a common humanity. And within that binding of common humanity are some very strong values and principles. And I think we all need to keep a keen eye on those to make sure that we ask good questions, recognize our failings, and are able to see the impact of the work that we do and say that it may not always be good for everybody, or may not even be good at all. Tough questions to ask, but they're crucial to, they must be asked.
Yeah, there is something I don't have, I think, the words for it, because it's like a recurring theme, now, whether we talk education, medical system, or now more the solidarity economy. But it seems the social theme, you know, and I completely actually agree with you on the water issue, for example. Like, it's just, like, there are commodities where it's our birthwright, yeah.
Yeah, as we should have outlawed bottled water.
Like, in the 70s decades, or whenever it was started, or the 80s when it was started to being bottled, or I think where the idea was born, was it in the 80s? And I think it was Nestle, which is, yeah. Anyway, so... and the common thread I see is this, it's so important for our society, like without this core, like education, you know, medical care, access to also finance and stuff, et cetera, is so crucial to our well-being. And I don't really understand why it's not inbuilt in our economy.
Because you can't quantify it. And it's easy to claim. and potentially not do. And I think our societies are complex. And so what's great about the world of finance is it's so easy to quantify.
So because we can't quantify it, we can't understand it. And so this is why it's left out until basically to the cracking point, right? Where, you know, societies are driven to a cracking point. And then all of a sudden we bring it back in. You know, do we really have to break down in order to reinvent?
Yeah, why not?
I think also what you're saying is, where do we go from here? Which is always hard to determine. But I think, you know, you mentioned earlier about these media headlines. Often feel like the media headlines determine where we're going. You know, it's climate crisis, it's inequality is growing. And sometimes it can feel completely overwhelming, as if, you know, the world's like we're in Jurassic Park and we're just going to get eaten by crazy dinosaurs. I'm being very simplistic here. But I think what's really important is, where are we going? And I think I firmly believe that where we need to go is really just to go back to our humanity and really find what are the values and principles which bring us all together, and find, use those as our guiding light that tells us how to operate. And the other thing that I really, really think we need to do is we need to make sure that we keep asking ourselves those critical questions. I don't think that this is a big step. I think values and principles are deeply embedded in our economics, and it's deeply embedded in our societal fabrics. Western, Eastern, Southern, I don't think it matters where you come from. They are, you know, people are social creatures, and they live together based on because of common values. But we have to really shift our thinking away from competition being the way that we assert dominance, and recognize that the collaborative economy that is captured in the concept of social and solidarity and in social entrepreneurship is very powerful. And if we really want to capture what humanity is in our economic and social structures, then we really need to shift our thinking away from a competitive mindset to one where we have a collaborative mindset.
You know, it's clear how complicated this conversation is, because, you know, everyone is trying to figure out, how do we create socially responsible organizations that actually have a positive impact but sustain themselves? I mean, and I think that's kind of really gets to the core of what we talk about always on this podcast, which is, how do we maintain our focus on sustainability and equity, yet also enable people to fulfill on their dreams and have the business interactions they want to have and have a high quality of life? And, you know, I think Karen really gets to the core of that question from an almost a philosophical / organizational standpoint. But it's also clear that the answer isn't here yet.
There is something in, like, which actually also on this podcast comes always back. It's like a repeating theme almost. It's like, how can I explain it? So as Einstein said, we can't solve our problems with the same thinking we used when we created them. And I think this is something we are dealing a lot.
Right.
In a lot of conversations on our podcast. And I thought we were especially dealing it with Karen. And not, I mean, she's trying to tackle that, the problem, like, finds a base of rethinking the middle ground.
Yeah,
that's social entrepreneurship, right?
No, I think
and
that's
yet,
totally
there
true.
Are so many other actors in this field, including social media and mass media, and there is, it's a complexity on a weird level.
Yeah, but I do think there is becoming kind of a critical mass of people wanting to tackle this issue, wanting to look at business models, wanting to look at alternatives or see past the current system to see how can we really become sustainable, not just for the planet, but for our businesses. Maybe the idea is that we don't have to be sustainable necessarily in terms of profit making, but we want to be sustainable in terms of the goals of our organization, whatever they are.
You're right. I mean, there are more and more people who also try, you know, decide to live in co-op housing. In what form? I mean, there are different forms of co-ops housing, but more corporative let properties and managed properties. There are cooperative organizations, right? I mean, it's actually not that complicated.
If you think about it,
you know, it's just you want to be part of. You want to have a better life, and you want to be basically join maybe a more collective way of living, working, and be satisfied with what you have.
Yeah, I mean, I think that conversation, like about the solidarity economy and what it really means, is kind of a more collaborative economy, more less competition, and more models that include things like cooperative organizations. And you're right, the examples of housing are really primary there, with really powerful examples where everyone contributes and everyone benefits, right? There's also employee-owned businesses where, you know, the employees benefit from the profitability of the company, but they also get to exercise their collective values in the operation of that company, like your King Flower company, right? That's an employee-owned company. So there are new models popping up, and some are very successful.
I don't think it's actually so new, you know. It's maybe becoming just more popular.
Well, it's becoming necessary, you know, because pure profit is no longer really very viable. And I actually don't agree with her that we should embrace the whole spectrum. I actually believe every company should have a value system, and also almost like a Hippocratic oath, do no harm. Because we know that a lot of companies don't have that value. They do harm, and they don't take responsibility.
Right. Yeah, for sure. And that is, I mean, this profit, another reappearing theme on the podcast is profit, right? And do we agree with profit? Yes or no, is it good or not? And of course, it depends on the context.
Yeah, of course. And the values. Right?
Exactly. We need to, I think, in the end of the day, it comes back to agreement. And I hope we all agree that we really need to change the way we do business. We are an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Brought to you by Game Changers, www.gamechangers.world. For the price of one latte per month, you can help fuel our work and keep our content untainted by commercial interests.
For more exclusive content, join us on patreon.com or click donate on potofgold.world.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul. I'm Mel Wymore.
And I'm Stephanie Overbeck.
Thanks for listening.